This is an interview with Sir Richard Mottram on the 28th of February 2008 at Chatham House, London. Firstly, I'd like to thank you for agreeing to take part in this.
My pleasure.
To jump straight in.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a broad question.
Mm-hmm.
During your time in the MOD, do you think Britain benefited from its nuclear cooperation with the United States? Either politically or maybe financially?
Well, I think politically it was sort of part of a sort of broader nexus of things which you can either regard as being significantly beneficial, or some people would argue were not, in the, you know, the intelligence relationship, the nuclear relationship. These were all things which were particularly close and which reinforced the sense of that we had a special relationship. Now, did we benefit financially? Well, quite clearly, the path we went down in the way in which we chose to procure our nuclear deterrent was a lower risk, cheaper option than to have gone down a route of independence, and every time we tried to be more independent, we discovered the costs and the risks. The benefit, I think, of the particular benefit, obviously, of the MDA was that it enabled sort of peer review of our nuclear weapons effort, and that it had to be an advantage to us to be joined up to a much bigger player. Equally, it had to be an advantage to the United States to have somebody on the inner track within a very tight circle who could peer review what they were doing. So it was mutually beneficial. You know. Like the intelligence relationship, where people say, but you know, the British put in a very small amount relative to the amount the Americans put in, but the Americans have put that amount in anyway, and what they're getting is something else, and they're getting a community and a dialogue. And I think also these are sort of quite, in a funny way, these are quite sort of they're narrow circles of people, and it can be quite a lonely business, I think. So actually having a partner has sort of psychological benefits, in a funny way.
Take you to the Duff Mason Group.
Yeah.
The committee chairman.
Yeah. Of which I was the secretary.
Yeah. Can you just explain its genesis and also maybe the political sensitivity within Whitehall about it? Because the Chevalier project and...
Yeah, well, the sensitivity about it was that essentially the system, the Ministry of Defence in particular, was saying that if we were to retain our nuclear deterrent in the longer term, then we had to think about a replacement for Polaris. And we needed to think about that in a time frame which was politically very awkward, because the then Labour government, the 1974 Labour government, had, I think, a manifesto commitment, which was probably to get rid of nuclear weapons. I mean, they always had these...
They agreed not to get a new deterrent.
Yeah, that's right. They always had these forms of words which meant... one thing to most people, and something tightly specified, therefore, in a way that saw loopholes for others. But as you say, usually they were formulations about not modernising, not doing this, not doing that. And that was always a serious constraint. So there was a sort of technological imperative alongside a political constraint. And then secondly, there was an inner core of ministers who all had different viewpoints on the fundamental merits of should the deterrent be replaced, and if so, how. So the Prime Minister was encouraged to recognise this problem had to be tackled.
Wilson or
Cameron. He was a very responsible person who wanted to tackle it. The Defence Secretary, Fred Mulley, really was very unenthusiastic about the whole issue, and I think essentially wanted it to go away. The Foreign Secretary had very clear views, David Attlee, he had very clear views about the right answer. And the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Dennis Healey, obviously knew an awful lot about defence, but would have been very, very concerned about cost and so on. So this was not really a very propitious environment in which to move this study forward. However, it was decided to do it, and what was interesting about it, I suppose, was that a number of things were interesting about it. First thing was it took quite a while to get it going because of all of these problems really at a high level. What if, for example, if it had come out that it was being done? You know, so you could quite see why ministers were very nervous about it. Political environment was very difficult. What were they going to say if it came out that this work was being done? And as I can't now remember, but I'm pretty sure it didn't come out. But anyway, eventually it was agreed it would be set up. And it was set up, the reason why it was Duff Mason was because it was decided that, and this was both a good thing in itself, I think, but also reflected the sort of political imperatives. It was decided that there was a requirement to think about what was the case for the deterrent, and that was therefore a group under Tony Duff. And so the prior question was, do we need such a thing? What should be its characteristics? And then, on the assumption that the answer to that might be yes, we do, there was a group under Ron Mason, the Ministry of Defence Chief Scientific Advisor, and of course the UK principal for the 58 agreement. There was a group under him that looked at technological aspects. And this turned into quite an interesting study. Now, on the case for what we did was, wrote a paper which, unfortunately, all this is still classified and not released. Wrote a paper which did really advance both the case for and against, and concluded there was a case for, probably. Heavily around the sort of second centre of decision making type of argument. The technological issues were very, very interesting because there were sort of two strands, well, a number of strands in play, but two in particular. One was that we tried through Chevrolet. In a sense, we tried to have a UK element to our deterrent, which, and the advantages of Chevrolet were that it had a UK element, that it could plausibly be argued that we weren't merging our missiles, going to a new generation, all these things that seemed very important. And of course, along the way, we'd also discovered that this was very risky, very difficult, expensive, uncertain. For anyone who wanted a sort of low-risk approach to life, you could immediately see the attraction of accessing a successor system, which was the standard US model. But of course, to be the standard US model, it would then be a MIRVed system. It's quite hard to argue that isn't a very modern deterrent, you know. So that was one strand. In the early 70s, at least, there'd been issues around whether the Americans would want us to have such a system. There was an issue there. And then in parallel to that, some argued that there was a sort of, what you could characterize as a sort of cheaper, more cheerful system that didn't raise some of these political issues and might be financially better. Around cruise missiles. And in those days, the sort of technology of cruise missiles was developing in very interesting and exciting ways and was quite new. Seems to come natural number of that, but you know, it was quite new and quite innovative and interesting, and the sort of accuracy that you could achieve with a cruise missile.
Claude Owen must have been. He's told me.
Who was the big proponent?
Lord Owen.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, so he had this new thing. Politically, it would look different. You might be able to have a minimum deterrent that you might I don't know, fire, you could fire an Edmonton sort of submarine, you could air launch it, you could do all these things. And so the study became, the Mason work became quite interesting set of choices where you'd got an alternative on the table. And David Owen was very keen on it. And I think in his memoirs he sort of explains some of that. I think the official system was quite cautious about it, essentially because of doubts about whether over time it would have the same penetration capability as ballistic missiles. So, you know, obviously cruise missiles have been around a long time and you can defend against them. And you can defend against them possibly in a more confident way than you can defend against a ballistic missile. But anyway, so all of this was gone through, the sort of official conclusion was that the best way forward, the lowest risk, probably the lowest cost, the highest confidence solution was Trident. But that was dependent on whether the Americans would give it to us. And on the politics of it, and of course the politics of it changed because the government changed and so on.
Was Thatcher coming into power, did it make it easier to approach for Trident?
Well, I mean, what actually happened, I'm so sorry, I've got a cough,
Guadalupe, Jim Callaghan had got some sort of agreement with Jimmy Carter to purchase Trident in his speech hub, as he tells us in his memoirs.
Yeah.
And, was it
easier
with Thatcher in power to?
Yes, because, what was going on here was there was some the work had been done. The work was submitted up through. I think it was so there were both the working part, the working groups, and then they in turn reported to a steering group, which I can't now remember. I assume was chaired by the Secretary of the Cabinet. This work, I'm sure it was actually. That they would then report on to ministers. Now, of course, this was all being done, I think this was in 78, this is all being done against a very, very difficult political background where it wasn't really going to be a winner for the Labour government to come out and say in the context in which they were working, we've got this great idea, we're going to replace Polaris, we're going to do it with Trident C4, and we're going to spend quite a lot of money on it, and that's all right, isn't it? Because it's entirely consistent with our manifesto and so on. So, and moreover, that would have been easier to do, I suppose, if you actually had a unified cabinet behind that proposition, or at least an inner core of the cabinet behind that proposition. But you didn't really have that either. So, what was interesting was the workers in Callaghan. Callaghan had a strong sense of what was right. From the point of view of the country, you know, as the Prime Minister, he gets one obstacle out of the way, which was quite an interesting obstacle. Would the Americans actually give us C4? With a president who had very strong views about lots of nuclear things, and some people regarded as being a bit quixotic. I don't personally think that's true, but you know, I mean, Carter had a number of initiatives of various kinds. He'd rather shock the system. So was it obvious that he, Carter, would support this? And the Prime Minister, I thought, rather brilliantly handled this in the way these things get done, you know. He just went and asked him, and he said, yeah, sure. Now, that was one hurdle out of the way, but obviously, it was, if Labour had been re-elected, which there might have been, then there would have been much bigger hurdles about actually taking that forward. When the Conservatives came into office, this sort of changed completely the domestic political dynamic and made it all a lot easier, obviously.
Yeah. Moving on to Trident, really. Can you just explain the strategic rationale behind it? Is it the Moscow criterion? Is this still an aspect to British nuclear thinking?
When you say in which period are we asking this question?
82, 86.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the way to think about this is that the rationale for our deterrent was essentially a sort of second centre of decision-making argument. That was sort of link one in the chain of logic. Link two was that in order to do this, in order to be a successful deterrent against the Soviet Union, we needed to be able to, I forgot the precise jargon, but we needed to be able to threaten key aspects of Soviet power or something. If you're thinking about threatening key aspects of Soviet power, you probably are thinking about threatening where the key players in Soviet government operate from. But of course, without getting too much sensitive territory, the higher accuracy of Trident also opened up different ways of thinking about what precisely you were going to threaten. So you could imagine that you'd have a sort of tighter set of criteria about what you were threatening. But essentially, yes, you wanted to pose a challenge to the capacity of the Soviet state to continue to operate, appropriate to the nature of the gain they could get from threatening the UK. So that implied that, yeah, if they had defences, you would want to be able to defeat those defences. And that, of course, was the essence of part of the argument. So were there other, for example, could you conceive of other deterrence criteria which did not require you to penetrate the Soviet defences? And you clearly can imagine ways in which you could threaten overwhelming destruction to lots of other, let's say, Soviet cities. And that's an alternative way of thinking about the problem. But whether, when you thought about that, whether in order to get equivalent sort of deterrent effect, you might need to threaten quite a lot, and in any case, did you want a sort of city-threatening strategy? All these sorts of considerations have been gone into. But the definitive statement is in the very careful wording, I think, of the white paper that was published in whenever, when the Trident decision was confirmed by the Thatcher government. The white paper written by Michael Quinlan. That's all in there, really.
Back to Trident, really. Was any other sort of system for maybe Anglo-French cooperation which had been under Heath, or been suggested under Heath, really, in the early 70s? Was under the Thatcher government, was that seen as a possibility, or was that just a no-brainer?
Well, it wasn't a no-brainer in the sense that an alternative to, quite clearly, an alternative path to the one we'd gone down was an Anglo-French path. Now, in order to make that a realistic option, you had to have confidence that we could continue to develop our own nuclear weapons in circumstances where obviously we'd have changed the frame of reference from an Anglo-American frame to perhaps an Anglo-French frame or an Anglo-French-American frame. And that aroused acute sensitivities, which we can come back to. So that was consideration number one. And then consideration number two was, could we, theoretically at least, harmonise our procurement cycles for the missile systems and produce an equally cost-effective solution to the procurement of a ballistic missile? And that depended on the French cycle in relation to our cycle of replacement and the costs of an Anglo-French development and so on. Now, when you got into the second of those, the issue always was going to be, we had, after all, in the UK, had our own efforts to produce ballistic missiles, which had not been particularly happy or successful, and eventually were abandoned, which had led us into the relationship with the Americans on Skybolt, on whatever the air launch thing was, Skybolt.
Yes, Skybolt.
Yeah. That in turn had led to Polaris as a solution which was off the shelf, so to speak. And similarly, what a Chevalier taught us, it taught us the risks of doing our own front end. And you can imagine those being multiplied up in developing more sophisticated front ends. Meanwhile, we watched the French do go it alone and spend a lot of money to produce a result. So institutionally, I think, inside the British government, there were over the years different perspectives. At a political level, there was always an attraction in building a relationship with France, including a defence relationship, and indeed using a defence relationship to offset some of the difficulties in other relationships. And you can see that on a continuing basis. So there was an institutional drive, usually coming out of the Foreign Office and the policy bits of the Ministry of Defence, that was quite sympathetic to Anglo-French cooperation. At the political level, enthusiasm varied. So under Heath, there was interest in using Chevalier as a way of not reinforcing our dependence on the Americans. So that would have opened up options, but those options proved unrealizable, I suppose. Under a Conservative government of Mrs. Thatcher, her interest in pursuing an Anglo-French avenue as opposed to an Anglo-American avenue was obviously going to be fairly limited. There wasn't much bite there. And then there were two other, in this argument, there were always two other constituencies which were important. One was, in the context of the 58 agreement, there was always very, very great caution about our doing anything in relation to the French that might lead the Americans to believe that we were not fulfilling our obligations under the 58 agreement. And so that was a sort of absolute constraint in the way we all worked. We mustn't compromise our relationship with the Americans. And that was always very interesting because we knew, or we suspected rather, that the Americans themselves had a dialogue with the French. And over the years, therefore, you could develop quite interesting conversations with the Americans and with the French, but always within this constraint. Right. So that was a very serious bar, actually, to moving this forward. And then the military, I think, were pretty unenthusiastic. And the Royal Navy could never see a rationale for, why would you do something with the French if you could do something with the Americans? I think the Royal Navy could see such an argument. And I've gone on about this, because I think in relation to all these nuclear things, there are sort of four overlapping sort of circles of interest. There's a military dimension, there is the official policy machine, which I was a member. There's the science nexus under the 58 agreement, and above it there is the political relationships. And you have to manage all four relationships and the sensitivities in them to try and produce a result. And at any time you were doing this, the natural habits of cooperation and the overall political frame and the low risk associated with working with the Americans tended to trump any alternative. And I mean, I'm a tremendously pro-French person myself. I'm a great Francophile, and I have very good relations with a number of people who've worked over the years in the French government. But you have to say that working with the French government was also very difficult because they had enormous sensitivities in this area, and therefore it was, for reasons I quite understand actually, and therefore, again, it was quite a hard thing to move forward with them. But if you look, you know, you can see over the last whatever many years, you can see cycles of enhanced cooperation and interest in developing a dialogue, including on nuclear matters, with the French, but always within the constraint of the rules of the 58 Agreement.
Pretty self-evident. Well, I gather an indigenous project was just
no.
Moving on to the end of the end of the 80s. End of the Cold War,
yeah.
The collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
The reason for NATO's existence maybe is gone because there's no longer the enemy, so to speak.
Well, I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah, do you think, I mean, were the fears within your department about maybe the Americans might retreat to some sort of neo-isolationism and with it Anglo-American nuclear cooperation goes, or was the belief always the Americans were going to stay involved?
It's an interesting question. The I suppose the answer is, in the late 80s, when all of this, when you had these amazing events unfold, well, if you go back a bit, what is, I think, in a way, more interesting is some of the big, I'll answer your question in a second, some of the really big shocks to the system actually came under President Reagan. So, for example, when President Reagan launched his Star Wars initiative, that was launched with virtually no notice to the UK. Probably a matter of hours. And that raised very interesting issues potentially for our deterrent, because the Americans were quite happy really to recognize that they would go down this route, in the sense that if the Russians wanted to go down this route, they could do it too. And perhaps our deterrent would have been compromised. Then Reagan flirted with essentially abolishing nuclear weapons. And again, he would do his flirting with very little notice. Very interesting guy, really. And in the UK, end of this, was Mrs. Thatcher had very clear views about the right way forward. Very interesting relationship, both with Reagan actually and with Gorbachev. She was quite an interesting big international player, but she was quite clear that one mustn't sort of flirt with these dangerous notions, very naive, etc. So that occasionally, that was quite a testing time. And also in that period, there were a number of difficult alliance-wide issues where the British government played a very significant role alongside the American government. So the decision to deploy ground launch cruise missiles and so on, including in the UK. And these were all, and a whole series of sort of NATO nuclear issues, and these were all very important, I think, in the context of the bilateral nuclear relationship, because the British were willing to take a very forward and constructive role in the broader alliance context of nuclear planning. And that role, working very closely with the Americans, and also working closely actually with the German government, that role was of importance to the Americans and helped cement very close relationships at both official level and ministerial level. So we were not operating a bilateral nuclear relationship in isolation. We were operating it in a very constructive way alongside a deep dialogue about the best way forward for the alliance as a whole in relation to nuclear matters. And that helped build and reinforce mutual confidence and sort of cope with some of these shocks. Now, when it came to the late 80s, what I think, there were some quite surprising turns there. The then American government, I think, handled all of those issues with great skill under Bush 41. With great skill, and the policymakers who were handling those issues under Bush 41 were very well known to the British system, and we had very close links with them. And we were essentially proceeding on the basis that we were moving into a new world where there would be constructive engagement with the Soviet Union, where the whole rules of the game in Europe were going to change. But the assumption was that, really throughout, the assumption was that the Americans were going to take the lead in managing this process. And because there was intrinsic uncertainty about what was going to happen, then you would need an insurance policy and a framework in which you could build new relationships. And so NATO didn't really come into question, and there was no suggestion that... So it's a very interesting question you raised. There was no suggestion that the Americans were going to essentially say, well, we've won, and therefore we can go home. You know, I mean, I've been reading over the last few weeks, rereading stuff about the alliance during the Second World War and what happened after the Second World War, just for interest, you know, no other reason. And looking at the American debate then, well, in the late 80s, there was no equivalent debate, you know. So the process, I mean, had its tensions because it involved the reunification of Germany, which the official machine was very strongly in favour of, but which politically wasn't necessarily Mrs. Thatcher's favourite outcome, and so on. But there was no expectation that the Americans were not going to continue and lead this process. And what it, of course, did open up was new ways of thinking about the nuclear dimension of NATO strategy, and that was quite a big issue in the late 80s, early 90s, with a recognition that one response to the end of the Cold War should be that we could cut back on nuclear inventories and so on, and rethink NATO's strategy, rethink NATO's nuclear strategy. Not fundamentally to change it, but think about, well, how could it be delivered with a much smaller range of nuclear weapons and so on and so forth. And the British were very heavily involved in all of that.
On to NATO, and yeah. It's like future.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really a two-part question.
Yeah.
Do you think NATO should still exist as it is, really? And how do you think how do you think it should adapt? And should it have, like, out-of-region, like in Afghanistan, things like this? Should it operate in such things as in NATO, or should it be disbanded?
Well, I think the advantages of NATO are there are sort of political and military benefits that you get from that structure. The political benefits are that it can provide a framework of reassurance. So it has, I think, helped in this period of transition in Europe. It's helped to build confidence. I mean, if you ask a Russian policymaker, perhaps you should. They're not going to say the same thing. But I personally think that it's acted as a force for stability in managing that transition, and that this has been both true for the countries of Eastern Europe, but also actually in a way for Russia. Now, I think the Russians could do this rather differently, but I think taken as a whole, the politics of it have been, and the political role of NATO has been helpful to Europe. And it provides a framework which reinforces habits of cooperation between the United States and Europe, which I think are also highly beneficial and must be. I mean, I've not been in this particular field really since 1998, but which must have been beneficial at times when relationships otherwise in Europe between Europe and the United States were difficult and delicate. It forces people to turn up and talk to each other, which is quite a good thing, really, when they're pretty exasperated with each other. So that too, I think, is a middle plus. Now, the third thing about NATO is that, I mean, what is very, very good about it is, again, it's this massive bureaucracy, and this huge military bureaucracy, in a sense. But what is the benefit of this? This is an alliance which has generating mechanisms and capacities to organise the deployment and application of force on a multilateral basis. And that is quite a hard thing to do. And it seems not hard, but actually it is very hard. And you would, I think, dismantle that with great reluctance. So what I think you can obviously say is, well, a critic would say, well, it still exists because, you know, these institutions, they never pack in when the rationale quite clearly is gone, you know. And the rationale in relation to Russia, or the Soviet Union, or whatever, or the divide of Europe, quite clearly has gone, and we certainly shouldn't imply that it's not gone for good, and we should be building a very strong relationship with Russia, insofar as we can, which is a very hard thing to do for those reasons we talk about. That should be our goal. So it's not there in relation to its original rationale, so why keep it? Well, for that sort of mix of reasons. I think it's been quite a big ask, actually, as we've seen, to deploy forces on a NATO basis in a theatre like Afghanistan. And so I think we shouldn't be surprised that it's proved difficult. It raises very interesting questions about membership, of course, because if it's going to take on roles like Afghanistan, you know, why is its membership what it is? You know, why should Australia join or whatever? You know? And I think those are quite interesting questions.
On to the subject of arms control, do you think Britain still needs its deterrent now? And also, do you see much possibility of future bilateral arms reductions between the Russians and the United States, and how this would impact on the British deterrent?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think the rationale for Britain's deterrent is essentially twofold. The ostensible rationale for it is strategic, and that strategic rationale is, put crudely, is an argument that says it's very difficult to see how the world is going to develop over the next 20, 30, 50 years. Since the world is quite clearly the sort of geopolitical character is changing very radically, and since there must be a significant risk of further nuclear proliferation over this period, why wouldn't you hedge against this, insure against this, by the retention of your strategic deterrent? That's the rationale for it. Now, what is interesting about that rationale is all set out, you know, in the government's white paper. It's all fine, you know. Obviously, what's interesting about it is an issue about cost effectiveness. So, fine, you know. The interesting question is, well, it does cost quite a lot of money. So, is it worth the money it costs? No, the government, I think, has reached a view about that. The only point I'd make about that is, the thing I find very unconvincing is the sort of argument that says, well, this is all very special, and so, you know, if there's pressure on the defence budget, we have to make sure that, you know, it's protected, and it mustn't cut across our conventional forces, etc. Those arguments I find very, very unconvincing. We should have a view about how much money we're prepared to spend on defence, and then we should say, is this a key component? If it's a key component, then okay, you know, it's I've got an opportunity cost, which is we could have more of something else, either more of a conventional defence or more of whatever, you know. So that bit of the rationale I found weak to the point of non-existence. But then there's also a deeper political issue, isn't there? I mean, which government is going to be the government that gives this up? So, so you have... I mean, to make a blindingly obvious point, once you're in this game, getting out of it is a very, very big statement. And getting out of it in circumstances where unilaterally getting out of it, I think is is difficult. I'll come to your second question in a second. And getting out of it in circumstances where there is another power in Europe, which is a nuclear power, might also be quite a big ask for any government. So you could put that the other way around and say, in the world of 2008, if you had a blank sheet of paper, would there be a compelling strategic rationale for a UK nuclear deterrent? I think that's, you know, that's an interesting question. That is a question that you can legitimately debate. But that isn't quite where we are. We are where we are. We have this long history. We have this 50 years of cooperation. We have a conception of ourselves as a country. We operate alongside other countries.
Do you think it gives Britain more clout on the political scene having its deterrent?
No. I don't think it does, very, and I think that I think well, it's not an argument I'd like to deploy anyway. But I don't think it does. However, giving it up would be a statement, of course. And I think a very difficult statement for any government to make. So that so essentially, you've got an argument here, which is you have a set of sort of international political and policy considerations, and there is the world is unbearable. It could all go pear-shaped. It's all very uncertain. It's an insurance policy alongside Britain as a major power, member of the Security Council, one of the top three powers in Europe. There's all that. And then there is domestic political considerations. So this is an argument which is a non-argument for the Conservative Party because of their view of the world, their view of Britain's role in the world, their history. And for the Labour Party is an argument absolutely not to be had because it's reminding oneself of that awful remedy one used to have. So for them it's a very, very difficult issue and it's sort of totemic, not to tackle. And the cost is manageable and the impact of giving it up, put another one in, would the decision by the British government to give up nuclear weapons itself have a major impact on other countries? Well, the answer to that is absolutely not. So the weakness in the unilateralist argument always seemed to me to be that in a way it was a reflection, in quite an interesting way actually, it was a reflection of the exaggerated sense we have of the importance of Britain. So we thought that the people who are most keen to have the deterrent and the people who are most keen to give it up are, in a sense, they never accept this, but their chips off the same block because the givers up think that Britain is so important, if we made this gesture, the rest of the world is going to say, my goodness, we don't see the way forward, which is just rubbish. Exaggerated, but you know what I mean? So it's not a compelling argument of that kind. Now, then to come to your question about arms control, I rather doubt myself whether there will be further, I'm not an expert on this anymore, but there will be further American, Russian arms control agreements. The Russians is a quality question for political reasons, really. Other existing agreements, so it's not a propitious time. I personally think, that the Russians and the Americans could operate with much smaller numbers of nuclear weapons, each having much smaller numbers of nuclear weapons, and still have confidence in their own security. What I never thought was plausible or sensible was to imagine that the British deterrent should get caught up in this process, because if you look at it over time, one of the ways in which British governments have both managed their international obligations obligations, or their sense of their international obligations under the NPT, and tried to manage the domestic political concerns about the nuclear deterrent is by focusing on keeping it as small as possible. And so you know you're in an interesting situation where, I don't know the detail of this anymore because I didn't do it, but where for instance, you know, we moved from Trident C4 to Trident D5. Why did we do that? Because absolutely we were concerned to maintain commonality with the Americans from a procurement point of view. We never have exploited the full potential of four boats with Trident D5 in terms of destructive power. Actually, what we've done is the reverse. We have, successive British governments have looked at opportunities actually to reduce the scale of our deterrent in keeping with the changing international situation. And I personally think that that is the right way forward. But you're therefore in a situation where the numbers of warheads we have and so on mean that I don't think it's meaningful for us to participate. And I don't see how you'd frame the reference anymore anyway. I mean, what are we supposed to have, you know, parity between the Russians? Is it going to be like sort of, I suppose it'd be like naval treaties, you know, the Russians and the Americans have whatever, you know, like the Washington, like the Washington Treaty, they can have whatever, and we can have, and we can have whatever. You know, you could frame something like that, but I think in any negotiation in which you framed it, because our deterrent is so small, the number we asked for would have to be bigger than what we've got, probably. So I don't think it's, you know, rather like these naval treaties, actually. So I don't think that, I don't think it's a practical proposition. I think you're best to say there is a history of strategic arms limitation processes between the Soviet Union and the United States, and Russia and the United States, as Russia is the successor of the Soviet Union in this respect. If they want to play this game, they've got plenty of scope to play it, and, you know, frankly, it's a matter for them, really.
Yeah. Well, that pretty much rounds it up. Thank you very much for a very, very interesting conversation.
Yeah. And, no, enjoy it.